Chapter 10 Bell gunned the engine, seized the caboose's ladder in his right hand, and jumped. His fingers slipped on the cold steel rung. He heard the Packard Wolf crash into the telegraph pole behind him. Swinging wildly from one arm, he glimpsed the Wolf tumbling down the embankment and fought with all his strength to avoid the same fate. But his arm felt as if it had been ripped out of his shoulder. The pain tore down his arm like fire. Hard as he tried to hold on, he could not stop his fingers from splaying open. He fell. As his boots hit the ballast, he caught the bottom rung of the ladder with his left hand. His boots dragged on the stones, threatening his precarious grip. Then he got both hands on the ladder, tucked his legs up in a tight ball, and hauled himself up, climbing hand over hand until he could plant a boot on the rung and swing onto the rear platform of the caboose. He threw open the back door and took in the interior of the caboose in a swift glance. He saw a brakeman stirring a vile-smelling stew pot on a pot-bellied wood stove. There were tool lockers, trunks on either side with hinged tops doubling as benches and bunk beds, a toilet, a desk stuffed with waybills. A ladder led up to the cupola, the train's crow's nest, where the crew could observe the string of boxcars they were trailing and communicate by flag and lantern with the locomotive. The brakeman jumped as the door banged against the wall. He whirled around from the stove, wild-eyed.
"Where the heck did you come from?"
"Bell, Van Dorn investigator. Where's your conductor?"
"He went up to the locomotive when we took on water."
"Van Dorn, you say? The detectives?" Bell was already climbing the ladder into the cupola from where he could see the train cars stretching ahead. "Bring your flag. Signal the engineer to stop the train. A saboteur is riding in one of the freight cars." Bell leaned his arms on the shelf in front of the windows and watched intently. 50 cars stretched between him and the smoke-belching locomotive. He saw no one on the roofs of the boxcars, which blocked his view of the low-slung gondolas. The brakeman climbed up beside Bell with a flag. The stew smell was worse in the raised cupola. Or the brakeman hadn't bathed recently.
"Did you see anyone stealing a ride?" Bell asked.
"Just one old hobo. Too crippled to walk. I didn't have the heart to roust the poor devil."
"Where is he?"
"About the middle of the train.
See that green cattle car?
The old man was riding in the box right ahead of it."
"Stop the train."
The brakeman stuck his flag out a side window and waved frantically. After several minutes, a head bobbed up from the locomotive cab.
"That's the conductor. He sees us.
Wave your flag." The locomotive's chugging slowed down. Bell felt the brake shoes grind. The cars banged into one another as they filled the slack caused by the train slowed to a stop. He watched the roofs of the boxcars.
"Soon as the train stops, I want you to run ahead and check each car. Do not engage. Just give a shout if you see anyone, then get out of the way. He'll kill you soon as look at you."
"Can't."
"Why not?"
"We have to send a flagman back when we stop."
"I'm it. In case the train's following us, I have to wave it down. Wires are screwy today."
"Not before you check each car," said Bell, drawing the Browning from his coat. The brakeman climbed down from the cupola. He jumped from the rear platform to the tracks and jogged alongside the train, pausing to look into each car. The engineer blew his whistle, demanding an explanation. Bell watched the rooftops and moved to either side of the cupola to see alongside the train. The wrecker lay on his back in a bench locker less than 10 feet from the cupola ladder, gripping a knife in one hand and a pistol in the other. All night he had worried that by setting loose the runaway gondola, he had put himself in danger by trapping himself so far up the line. Fearing that railway police, goaded by Van Dorn detectives, would mob the train before it reached Weed or Dunsmuir and search it thoroughly, he had taken decisive action. During the last water stop, he had run back to the caboose and slipped inside while the crew were busy tending the locomotive and checking the journal boxes under the rail cars.
He had chosen a locker that held lanterns, reasoning that no one would open it in the daytime. If someone did, he would kill him with whichever weapon suited the moment, then spring out and kill anyone else he came across. He smiled grimly in the cramped, dark space. He had guessed right. And who had boarded the train but none other than Van Dorn's chief investigator himself, the famous Isaac Bell? At worst, the wrecker would make a complete fool out of Bell. At best, he'd shoot him between the eyes. The brakeman checked every car, and when he reached the locomotive, Bell saw him confer with the conductor, the engineer, and the fireman who had gathered on the ground. Then the conductor and the brakeman hurried back, checking each of the 50 boxcars, cattle cars, and gondolas again. When they got to the caboose, the conductor, an older man with sharp brown eyes and a put-out expression on his lined face, said, "No saboteurs, no hobos, nobody. The train is empty. We've wasted enough time here." He raised his flag to signal the engineer. "Wait," said Bell. He jumped down from the caboose and ran alongside the train, peering inside each car and each chassis underneath. Midway to the locomotive, he paused at a green cattle car that stank of mules. Bell whirled around and ran full tilt back toward the caboose. He knew that smell. It wasn't stew, and it wasn't an unwashed brakeman. A man who had ridden in the green cattle car that stank of mules was now hiding somewhere in the caboose. Bell bounded up onto the caboose's platform, shoved through the door, flung the nearest mattress off a bench, and pulled up the hinged top. The locker held boots and yellow rain slickers. He flung open the next. It was filled with flags and light repair tools. There were two more. The conductor and the brakeman were watching curiously from the far door. "Get back," Bell told them, and he opened the third bench. It contained tins of lubricating oil and kerosene for lamps. Gun in hand, he leaned in to open the last. "Nothing in there but lanterns," said the brakeman. Bell opened it. The brakeman was right. The locker contained red, green, and yellow lanterns. Angry, baffled, wondering if the man had somehow managed to run for the trees from one side while he was watching the other, Bell stalked to the locomotive and told the engineer, "Move your train." Gradually, he calmed down. And finally he smiled, remembering something Wish Clark had taught him. "You can't think when you're mad, and that goes double when you're mad at yourself." He had no doubt that the wrecker was a capable man, even a brilliant one, but now it seemed he had something else going for him, too. Luck, the intangible element that could throw an investigation into chaos and prolong capture. Bell believed it was only a matter of time before they caught up with the wrecker, but time was short, terribly short, because the wrecker was so active. This was no ordinary bank robber. He wasn't going to hole up in a brothel and spend his ill-gotten gains on wine and women. Even now, he would be planning his next attack. Bell was painfully aware that he still had no idea what motivated the man. But he did know that the wrecker was not the sort of criminal who wasted time celebrating his victories. 20 minutes later, Bell ordered the train stopped beside Lillian Hennessy's special, which was still on the siding. The crew moved the freight ahead to the water tank. The wrecker waited until the train crew was busy taking on water. Then he dropped down from the cupola's shelf and slipped back into his first hiding place, the lantern's locker. The next water stop, he slipped out of the caboose and back into a boxcar, as the crew would be reaching for lanterns when the sun went down. 10 hours later, in the dead of the night, he jumped off at a staging area at Reading. Seeing many detectives and railroad police searching trains ahead, he hid in a culvert and watched their lights bobbing in the dark. While he waited them out, he used the time to think about Isaac Bell's investigation. He was tempted to mail him a letter. "Sorry we didn't meet on the freight train." But it wasn't worth the joke. Don't gloat. Let Bell think he wasn't on that train, that he got away by some other means. He would find some better way to sow confusion. An empty freight rumbled out of the yard heading south, just before first light. The wrecker ran alongside, grabbed a ladder on the back of a boxcar, and worked his way under the car and wedged himself into the supporting framework. In Sacramento, he climbed out when the train halted for permission to enter the yards. He walked a mile through factories and workers' housing to a cheap rooming house, 8 blocks from the Capitol building. He paid the landlady $4 for holding his suitcase and carried it to another rooming house that he chose at random 10 blocks away. He rented a room, paying in advance for a week. Mid-morning, the house was empty, the lodgers away at work. He locked himself in the shared bathroom at the end of the hall, stuffed his filthy clothes in the grip sack, shaved, and bathed. In his room, he pulled a top-quality blonde wig over his hair and applied a similarly colored groomed beard and mustache with spirit gum. Then he dressed in a clean shirt, a four-in-hand necktie, and an expensive sack suit. He packed his bags, transferring his climbing spurs to the suitcase, and polished his boots. He left the rooming house by the back door so no one would see him in his new persona, and walked a roundabout route to the railroad station, checking repeatedly that he was not followed. He threw the grip sack behind a board fence, but kept the suitcase. Hundreds of travelers were steaming into the Southern Pacific Station. He blended in as he joined them, another well-dressed businessman embarking for a distant city. But suddenly, before he could stop himself, he laughed out loud. He laughed so hard he covered his mouth to make sure the beard didn't shift. The latest Harper's Weekly magazine was displayed on a newsstand. The cover cartoon depicted none other than Osgood Hennessy. The railroad president was rendered as a fearsome octopus extending train tracks like tentacles into New York City. Smiling broadly, the wrecker bought the magazine for 10 cents. The newsie was staring at him, so he went to another stand outside the station to ask, "Do you have pencils? A thick one. And an envelope and stamp, if you please." In the privacy of a toilet in the nearest hotel, he tore off the magazine cover, wrote on it, and sealed it in the envelope. He addressed the envelope to Chief Investigator Isaac Bell, Van Dorn Detective Agency, San Francisco. He attached the stamp, hurried back to the station, and dropped the envelope in a mailbox. Then he boarded the flyer to Ogden, Utah, 600 miles to the east, a junction city near Great Salt Lake where 9 railroads converged. The conductor came through. "Tickets, gents." The wrecker had bought a ticket, but as he reached to pull it from his vest pocket, he sensed danger. He did not question whatever had sparked the premonition. It could have been anything. He had seen extra railway police at the Sacramento yards. The ticket clerk had eyed him closely. A hanger-on he had noticed in the passenger station could have been a Van Dorn operative. Trusting his instincts, he left his ticket in his pocket and flashed a railway pass instead.